coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome to today's Worth Doing Badly, our weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year. I am Jamie Krieger, your host. I am pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church in Cambridge, England, and manager of Lutheran Radio UK. I am joined on this show from the US by pastors David Weber and Ethan Stoppenhagen. On today's episode, we will look at the lessons for the ninth Sunday after Pentecost. And they are Deuteronomy 7 verses 6 to 9, Psalm 125, Romans 8 verses 28 to 39, and Matthew 13 verses 44 to 52. We begin, as we usually do, with David Weber.
These parables are meant to help us understand our dual citizenship, the difficulty of living simultaneously in two very different domains, the kingdom of heaven and the earthly domain. So the parables are introduced with the kingdom of heaven is like, and then the parables cast light on what this kingdom of heaven is like. So the earthly domain's defining characteristic is the inescapable loss and death that Jesus says is expressed in weeping, anguish, and angry, gnashing teeth. Anguish and anger are the defining characteristics of the first kingdom we dwell in, the kingdom of earth. The defining characteristic of the domain of heaven is determined by Christ the King. It's a kingdom or a king domain, and particularly Christ the King's overcoming loss by cross and resurrection. So, we have dual citizenship in the kingdom of heaven, and that promises us a better hope and joy, not because we're insulated from loss, but because the kingdom of heaven outlasts and overcomes our experience of loss. And parts of these parables show just how seemingly unreal life in the kingdom of heaven would seem, but we have to remind ourselves over and over again, if loss is real, and no one doubts that loss is real, then hope and joy that is offered by the kingdom of heaven will prove to be even more real because it will prove to be lasting and good. So the parables help us with our having 2 feet in each kingdom, or a foot in each kingdom, a dual citizenship. The first parable is of a lost treasure. It candidly presumes that loss is the basic experience of life. Loss is inescapable in the earthly domain, where there is moth and rust and thieves. So the parable begins with loss. And unlike other lost stories like Treasure Island, Jesus ignores the question of how the treasure came to be lost and buried. And he doesn't touch on the effect that this loss had on the loser. The parable begins with loss. And it's unconcerned with the loser, weeper, and gnasher. The parable is all about the joy of the one in the kingdom of loss who is the finder keeper. That is, that's what we're focused on. And the either or of the parable is, how do we escape the anguish and anger of loss by finding a better and more lasting treasure hidden deep within the experience of loss? This is, we are not ever promised to be insulated from loss, but in our losses, there we discover the truth of Christ's kingdom. And when that promising but hidden treasure is found, the apparently foolish man does something that seems to everybody foolish. He sells all of his earthly possessions and impulse buys a vacant field. And I just found it kind of funny. I wonder how he explained this to his wife and children, that they'd be moving out of their home into a vacant property. It would be impossible to actually explain to somebody that in finding this hidden treasure, it changes the way that they live in this world in a rather seemingly foolish way. He will remain a joyful fool until the value of his buried treasure is revealed in time. So our citizenship in the kingdom of heaven promises to unleash a hidden joy. Now, again, I have to remind myself, loss is undeniably real. It's this joy, this promise of joy, which seems absurd, which seems foolish. And yet that is the promise that in over time, the value of our citizenship of the kingdom of heaven will be revealed. And this means that time no longer moves willy-nilly toward loss and the inevitable weeping and gnashing of teeth. Time now measures our waiting for the value of this great treasure to be revealed. Time is the measure of this movement towards the fulfillment of our desire. And yet, because the treasure is hidden, the kingdom of heaven's joy will seem ridiculous and escapist, except then we ask ourselves again, if loss is real, then won't the joy and hope we have also be revealed to be more real? Right. So the second parable expands on this ridiculous joy when it imagines a merchant's discovery of a pearl of great value. Again, the discovery leads to precipitous and imprudent action of selling everything to obtain one desired thing. And I was just trying to think of a historical analogy of such ridiculous joy, and I came on the story of Secretary of State William Seward's 1867 purchase of Alaska. And it was purchased from Russia for $7.2 million. And at the time, critics called it Seward's Folly or Seward's Icebox, Seward's Polar Bear Garden. And from our perspective, to have this purchase made with all the benefits that it has, it seems ridiculous that he wouldn't have done this. But at the time, he seemed to be wasting hard-earned money. So by seeing our experiences of loss in this world as the way the Christian sells everything in order to have the most valued thing, everything is considered loss. It's getting rid of that stuff because a thing of higher value replaces it. So even loss becomes a part of the promised joy of the kingdom of heaven. Now, in the third parable, things change radically. The dragnet and the catch of fish takes our imaginative thinking about life in the domain of anguish and anger in a very different direction. Now, it is not we who seek the valuable but hidden treasure. It is Christ the King. And in his kingdom of heaven, he is seeking us, and no price was too high to save us from the fate of weeping and gnashing teeth. Christ, the King of the kingdom of heaven, is actively working in death's domain, sweeping the farthest seas to find every kind of fish. This is a relentless seeking. This is the kingdom of heaven is not just an idea, a beautiful thought. It is Christ at work in the kingdom of earth, seeking those who are suffer loss and in need of new citizenship in the eternal kingdom. The joy of Christ, the word Catholic, I think, is appropriate here. Universal outreach, however, is sadly tempered by this an ominously sad note. Christ's decisive, far-reaching, and ridiculous desire to save us from the world of weeping and gnashing of teeth can, in fact, be frustrated by those who, for no rational reason, refuse to desire to escape from the domain of weeping and gnashing teeth. We must not miss a point, I think, that this parable was spoken to disciples. That was Jesus' audience. They were the ones to hear the harsh words about a final apocalyptic division, even though they had no need to fear this awful vision. They were witnesses, and as witnesses, they would vicariously fear for those who do not sufficiently desire to be saved from the world of loss and the subsequent weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the disciples, in fearing vicariously, expect then that there would be triumph over this loss, that Christ was bringing them in to participate in his joyful mission to cast a wide net in order to offer dual citizenships to those who are locked into this kingdom of loss.
Do you think the disciples really did understand all these things that Jesus had said? Because I think of that, we have that Jesus explains everything and he asks, have you understood all these things? And they say, yes. But I just find it very hard to believe that they could have grasped it all. Unless, of course, they had experienced already the loss that comes with the kingdom.
No, I think this is why I like the fact that this is in Matthew, and there's a lot of Matthew yet to unfold. Yeah, they won't understand until the ultimate loss of Christ on the cross, where they thought everything was lost. And at that moment, I would think that, you know, so many of these teachings and parables would come rushing in as to why Jesus kept saying loss is not something we fear. Loss is a part of the whole story of coming to see that we've been saved from this loss. I mean, like anything, we understand it and we don't understand it. And we don't really know how much we don't understand until we're in the thick of these experiences. But do you find these three parables work together to make sense of this better hope?
Yeah, I think so. And you rightfully, I think, capture that shift with the last one that has sort of a more eschatological bent, I guess, you know, where we turn to the last days and we see what the treasure is, because otherwise we would be confused about the treasure. You know, we would think it's something we're seeking, or we have to go out and find. But the fact that we're the treasure redefines the rest of the parables for us.
This is what I wanted to say but didn't. So thank you. That there is a crescendoing that's taking place, and we all understand, you know, Treasure Island and finding a treasure. You know, I think, you know, when you find money on the side of the street, that just seems such a great experience. It's getting something for nothing, and no one ever says, oh, that the poor person who lost it. You know, we just presume loss is a part of this thing. But the three parables actually do lead us to recognize the joy of finding, and then to see that joy is Christ's. And this is what bothers me about that last parable, is that as soon as that joy is asserted, right, then Christ drops this thought bomb and says, but it is possible to frustrate that joy. Is there anything more absurd in life than people choosing anger and anguish over this? And I think that is a kind of a depth charge, or a bomb that goes off slowly, and especially when we recognize that these are real people that we know, that there's a certain sadness that Christ wants us to experience within this promise of hope and joy. Now, the one thing I would find it that I would want to preach on is just the utter confidence that Jesus has that the kingdom, the joy in the kingdom of heaven will in fact outlast and overcome any loss that we experience on the kingdom of earth. There's just this remarkable confidence. And I like that the parables say this confidence looks like absurdity to people from the outside. It looks as dumb as selling everything to buy a pearl. But so for a time, it will seem absurd. But the psalm is even more absurd in its claim that those who are beloved of God will never be shaken. Now, the psalmist's world was violently shaken by the invasion of the wicked and lawless Babylonians. And that included the destruction of Jerusalem, the desecration of the temple, and the displacement of the inhabitants. So in light of these events, it seems ludicrous to declare to those who trust, that those who trust God are never shaken. Now, this is a psalm of ascent. This is a psalm written after the exile had come to an end. And so when they look back in retrospect on the events of destruction and desecration and displacement, they recognize, yes, they were shaken, but there was something even more lasting and more decent and good than the evil they endured. And this is why the psalmist celebrates in this crazy kind of joy the unexpected events that took place with the restoration. And the psalm's reason for continually trusting that those who inhabit the kingdom of heaven are never shaken is that the forces of destruction could not destroy the mountain on which Jerusalem is built. It's as if the psalmist says, good try, but you really didn't destroy the one thing that would destroy our hope. That is the mountain, creation. God, the mountain was God's token that even though they suffered loss in the short term, God's kingdom was eternally righteous, and it was, and that God would be always uprighting the destructive works of the wicked. And the mountain was the image, the icon of that bit of trust. So trusting the truth of God's eternally uprighting righteousness meant that, quote, the righteous do not set their hands to wrongdoing. So it spells out, what does it mean to actually trust that God is righting everything that's wrong in the world? It means that the righteous never need to be tempted to do good by doing wrong. And the psalm imagines that the crooked ways of the wicked can never straighten life out. And so we are never to adopt wrongdoing in crooked ways. And I think that's a lesson that we do not get our direction from the way that the world works. We live in a different kingdom that works by different rules and ways. So the sign of the mountain is that we can trust that the King of Heaven intends to exercise his righteousness on earth for us to do good to the good. And because God is, the psalmist says, prays that God would do good to the good and to the upright in their hearts.
I'm really struck by that idea that God's promise of redemption is literally grounded in creation, in the mountain. That had never crossed my mind before, that the actual symbol of God's faithfulness is the mountain itself.
And it would seem absurd.
Right.
I mean, you would not expect the inhabitants of Jerusalem to be anything other than angry and anguished, right?
Right.
But had they understood this psalm, they could have said, that's all you have? You can only destroy Jerusalem? You can only destroy the temple? You know, if you're really going to make a mark in this world, you're going to have to move this mountain. I mean, it's kind of a funny picture, but in the end, I think that humor is in the psalm, is that, no, that even the most powerful destruction, even the most ghastly effect that it had, it isn't sufficient to overcome the hope and joy of the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, then you have Jesus speaking of the faith that moves mountains, right? The power of faith versus the powers of this world.
And there's so many other things outside these texts we could talk about.
It's endless.
The hard part is staying within the text, isn't it? No, but I think that that's called for. Then as soon as you see that the word mountain, then you think of all of the various things that have happened on mountains and the revelations that have taken place. So, but we'll leave that for another time. Deuteronomy speaks of us as God's treasured people. And again, here's where the texts support the gospel. This explains the parable of the dragnet and the fish, that we are God's, we are Christ's treasure and pearl. And he seeks us with a ridiculously self-destructive love. That's what the puzzle of the cross is. It's a love that dies. And he didn't die for us because we are intrinsically lovable. It is rather that Christ seeks, and that because he seeks and saves us, that's what gives us eternal worth. So what this passage helps us see is how loss actually serves Christ's purpose. That Christ does not insulate us from anguish and anger. He rather overcomes it. And in the overcoming, Christ saves us from this domain of death. There we appreciate the citizenship that we have in his kingdom. It is experiencing this movement from the domain of weeping and gnashing teeth to the kingdom of heaven, that we truly know the Lord is God and that his love is faithful. So even loss becomes a way of learning. The epistle works beautifully to cast light on the gospel lesson, especially where Paul says, all things work together for good. This is the utter confidence that the kingdom of heaven finally triumphs over the loss in the kingdom of earth. Everything, all things, good and bad, work together for good. That's what the psalmist saw. Even the Babylonian exile could work together to reveal the goodness of God. So, what Paul says is the most important thing about this. The fact is all things work together for good. But we don't know the facts. And for Paul, everything depends upon our knowing what is true and real. So Paul is forever talking about ways that we come to know these truths that are buried and yet magnificent, recalling the close connection between knowing and loving in scriptures. Most of the good that God promises comes from knowing him. So it's just not knowledge. It's the kind of knowledge that connects us to God, of knowing God. And Paul declares that we know, oidomen, we know that for God's beloved. So the knowing is that we are God's beloved. That's the first thing to know, that everything in this world is working towards the realization of the good. Everything is working together. Now, when we forget this, when we fail to know this, it looks like everything is falling apart. We say, what is the world coming to? And we expect people say that it's falling apart. It's coming to weeping and gnashing of teeth. Everything is becoming nothing, people say. And Paul confidently says, no, everything is working towards the good. And even the things in this world that are becoming nothing will eventually serve the purpose of the kingdom of heaven. So this weeping and gnashing of teeth expresses our tacit expectations that everybody believes all life ought to come together. We believe all of life should be Paul's symphony of goodness, which comes together in this goodness. And when it doesn't, we are surprised. We are frustrated. And we weep and gnashing our teeth. This means everyone naturally expects something like Christ's kingdom to make everything good. So this means our anguish and anger bear witness to the truth that every human being believes all things ought to come together into goodness rather than disintegrate into nothingness. And our hope the hope that Paul speaks of is that our desire for things to come together in goodness rather than fall apart in frustration is actually going to take place, is actually taking place even now. Because as Paul sees time, time is moving towards the realization and the revealing of the treasure that we have. His word is that we are being morphed, that we are being morphed into the image of the Son. So Jesus's life, death, and resurrection is not just, these are not just events in his life. That's the template. That's the mold that we are being morphed into. That what was true of Christ's life, death, and resurrection, we even now are being formed and conformed into that template, which means that every one of our frustrations that leave us weeping and gnashing our teeth in anger are slowly being morphed into this movement that's working together, where all anguish and anger come together in God's final goodness.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Go to the App Store or Google Play and get the one that is right for you for free. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other programs on our schedule, write me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. David and I will be back next week at this same time. Stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.